We're going to be studying today and the next two Sundays the story of Noah and the flood, and it's probably a familiar one to many of you. If you grew up in church and Sunday school, reading Bible stories as kids, then you're going to know this story, and there will be some helpful review here and hopefully some new insights that we can see together as well. And I want to thank our friend Glorice, who did another illustration for us, and I really like the beautiful job she did. She does this with paintings and with, I don't know what she uses actually. I think she does it with probably like a oil painting or a watercolor or a variety of different types. But this is a great picture just capturing the size of the ark, which we think of as ginormous, but compared to the size of the ocean and to a world covered in water, it was just a tiny little piece of driftwood out there in the middle of a vast ocean. So this really captures the idea of God's judgment, but at the same time, really his mercy and how God hates sin, and it is in God's character as a holy God. He must punish sin. He has no alternative. He must punish sin because it's in his nature and his right and good to do so, and yet he also has provided a refuge for us to find mercy in the midst of his judgment. So, of course, we're going to see today and in the next couple weeks that there has been judgment in the past and there is going to be judgment again in the future. In the past, God provided a way that people could find escape and refuge and survival, and in the future as well. And our hope is found in Jesus Christ. He is our shelter in the midst of a storm, and he is the one that protects us from God's coming judgment. So God, it's just so amazing to think about this, that he is both the judge and the punisher, but at the same time, he is also the merciful one that provides an escape from his own judgment. So he says, my character demands that I punish sin, and yet I'm going to provide a way to protect you from my judgment if you will run to that place and find Jesus as your hiding place. So we'll be seeing that as we go along. Hey guys, welcome. So Genesis chapter 6 is where we're going to start out today. And as a review from last week, we looked at Genesis 4, and we saw Cain and Abel, two of Adam and Eve's children, offer sacrifices to God. And what was interesting about those sacrifices is that God found Abel's sacrifice to be acceptable. It was a pleasing and acceptable sacrifice to God, but God did not find Cain's sacrifice to be acceptable. And as we study Genesis and we look at some other parallel passages in the New Testament that talk about that same event, we learn that Cain did not act in faith. Cain did not give of his best. And it appears that for whatever reason, God had told Abel and Cain what was expected, and Cain had not fulfilled God's expectation and had not given from a true and a righteous heart. And so Cain was resentful that Abel's sacrifice had been accepted and that his own had not. And God warned Cain, like, I noticed that your face has fallen. You seem angry. Why are you angry? Do you have good reason to be angry? God counsels Cain and warns him, you know, sin is crouching at the door. You have an opportunity to not give in to this temptation and to lash out in revenge. And yet instead of doing that, Cain rejects the counsel and the warning of God and ends up committing murder against his brother Abel. So the punishment for Cain was, of course, that he was instead of being a farmer for the rest of his life, which he enjoyed, and a worker of the field, he was cursed to be a fugitive and a wanderer. And he said this was a very difficult punishment for him to bear. He was afraid of others that would kill him, brothers, sisters, nephews, nieces, other family that would kill him because of what he had done to his brother. And we talked about the irony of how he had just taken a life, but now he's terrified of somebody taking his own life. So there's often a hypocrisy in sin there. And God did show mercy, didn't he? What was a way that God showed mercy to Cain in the midst of the horrible evil that he had committed?
Did he mark him?
Good. So he put a mark on him, which was, what was the purpose of that mark?
So no others would attack him, that they would receive the same punishment.
Some kind of a warning sign of, like, don't mess with him or God is going to judge you also.
Yeah, kind of in the same way. Which kind of goes up with the future, what it says, by whoever sheds a man's blood, what man shall his blood be shed, kind of a foreshadow, not an exact, but...
Yeah, yeah, I do think we're going to see that over in Genesis chapter 9, and that story in 4, and also what we're going to see here in 6 are preparing us for what's going to happen later on after the flood, and what God says is he reestablishes the human race and even sets up government and talks about a criminal justice system, capital punishment, things like that. That's all in light of things that have happened in those earlier 8 chapters. Good point. Another act of mercy is just the fact God could have struck him dead immediately. He had every right to do that, and yet he chose not to. And there are times that we wonder why the wicked seem to prosper. The psalmists battle with that. There are times that we look at the world around us, and it seems like the good guys sometimes struggle, and the bad guys seem to be doing well. And we wonder, like, how can this be? It seems topsy-turvy, like right is wrong and wrong is right, and the people who are wicked and blasphemous and that are profane, that they are the ones that God is blessing, and the people that are righteous, that they're the ones that are struggling. And we don't always understand those things. God, in his mercy, chose not to immediately judge Cain in the sense of he didn't take his life. He could have done that, but he extended his life. He gave him a long life. He gave him a wife. He gave him children. And yet there was still a difficult punishment and a discipline that he had to bear for what he had done wrong. And we are warned in the New Testament to beware of what Cain did and to see that as a path toward apostasy, turning away from God, and of denying God, and of giving into greed and anger and murder. And of course, all life is made in the image of God. Every single person is made in God's image. And we saw that in Genesis 1 and 2. That again will be underscored on the other side of the flood in Genesis chapter 9. And so we are responsible not only to just not kill. I mean, that's a good start. Don't go out and kill somebody this week. Hopefully we can do that. But then, of course, you know, Jesus even says that we're not to speak hateful thoughts. We're not to think hateful thoughts. We're not to, not just love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but love your neighbor and love your enemy. And we, in a sense, we commit a kind of murder when we're thinking hostile thoughts and when we're speaking vicious words toward people. Jesus says that's murderous in our hearts. And just as looking with lust is a form of adultery, thinking with hate is a form of murder as well. And because man and woman are all made in the image of God, we need to treat people and even think about people in a way that shows dignity and respect and kindness and love toward them as well. So those are some of the applications that come out of Genesis chapter 4. Chapter 5, that's not the focus of our study today, but I didn't want to just skip past that without mentioning a couple of things. Chapter 5 of Genesis is our first major genealogy in the Bible. It's a family tree. Anybody here like to do family history, studying family trees and genealogies? Anybody big into that? Mike, how far back have you kind of studied your family?
I had to actually look up my last name to see where it came from, because my grandparents didn't even know where it came from. And it goes back to England. It's a parish, the Chilcote Parish. It's a house of the children.
Oh, okay.
So that's how far back I've gotten.
That's really cool.
And then on my mom's side, it's the Reimer family. And they came from Prussia, and then they went to Russia, and then they were oppressed in Russia. And that was a whole escape from Russia. Mm. And they came to America, and they're the Amish, or the, what are the other ones? Mennonites?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the Mennonite families. And they're farming in Kansas and down into northern California. And then my mom got out of the whole Mennonite family, and she kind of, that's why she doesn't go to church. She was real strict, and she kind of got hurt by all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then now this came to me, so like four generation American.
All right.
So, yeah, they went through all that.
So you've got some farming and being out in the field kind of in your blood. No wonder you like to be out there hunting and camping and everything.
Yeah, my dad's side is all masonry. Like, they build houses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's all outdoorsy, guys.
Yeah, it is really interesting if you have the opportunity to learn a little bit more about grandparents, great-great-grandparents. You start going back a few generations. And, of course, Genesis 5 is not only the family tree for Adam and Eve all the way to Noah, but it really is our background as well. I mean, this is talking about our distant relatives and people that actually every one of us in this room share in common. This is our collective family tree going from Adam and Eve all the way to Noah and his three sons. And a couple of things that are interesting that I think are important to notice when you read through, particularly this genealogy here. One of them is the very long lives that these particular people had. If you look down at verse 5, it says that all the days that Adam lived were 930 years. 930 years. I mean, America has only been a country for 250 years or so. Like, wow. And you think about 900, you think about how much time passes and how much history that has taken place. I mean, you'd be back well into the Middle Ages if you're thinking about 900 years ago. This is the day of castles and crusades and things like that. And we know people that have lived maybe 80, 90, 100 years and how much the world has changed in that amount of time and all that they've seen take place. And yet here, Adam, and he's not alone. Adam lived 930 years, but you go down to Seth, his son, in verse 8, he lived 912 years. So he was still a youngin' when he died compared to his dad, Adam. No, but then you see in verse 11, Enosh lived 905 years. Kenan lived 910 years, according to verse 14. Jared, in verse 20, lived 962 years. He almost lived a millennium. And then the man that we believe lived longer than anyone else in human history is Methuselah. He's mentioned in verse 22. And then again in verse 25, when Methuselah had lived 187 years, he fathered Lamech. He lived after he fathered Lamech 782 years, had other sons and daughters. You do the math there. Verse 27, thus all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. And that's just simply stunning, the fact that people were living that long to such a degree that some have wondered, oh, well, did they have a different meaning of how they were calculating months and years? But the problem is that there's other family lists that are in the same book that are showing that the years got shorter and the lives got shorter as time went on. So shortly after the flood and then by the time of Abraham, like ages are going down to where, you know, Abraham lived, you know, 120-ish years, or no, a little bit longer than that. I don't remember, 150 or so. But they kept tapering down until Moses says in Psalm 90 that the average life is maybe 70 years, if by reason of strength, 80 years. So, you know, time went by to where lives were much more like we think of today. But these men lived an extremely long amount of time. There's a number of possibilities of why that is. One that's very likely is that this is closer to creation and there would have been less mutation and genetic disruption that would have been taking place. So you would have had more pure genetic coding in the human body and there wouldn't have been as much disease. There wouldn't have been as many kinds of problems that we face today to where people could have lived a much longer time and could have kind of, I mean, the body can kind of heal itself for a certain amount of time. And then of course, slowly we find ourselves dying. So it seems like going back earlier, you're getting a glimpse of how long life could have lasted. And imagine if Adam and Eve had not sinned, people would have lived forever. They would have literally been immortal. So it was only because of sin and then God putting the curse of death into the human race and into the genetic coding that lives began to get shorter and shorter and shorter and then tapered off. Another thought, another theory is that there probably was a different kind of ecosystem that the world was in prior to the flood. So it may have been somewhat different than what we find today. You think about the size of the animals that we have fossil record of, you know, things grew very big. And there seems to have been kind of a healthy, ideal growth environment, kind of a canopy of some sort. And so people may have lived a lot longer because of the healthy food they were eating, because of the ideal environment, maybe the effect of the sun that's had on people that's caused their lives to be shorter and different things. But it seems like by the time we get through Noah and the flood and then his offspring in a few generations, and by the time we get to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we're getting down closer to the kinds of lifespan and ages that we have today. I did a paper back in seminary on this Genesis 5 passage and compared the record that we have here, given, of course, this is written by Moses. Moses writes Genesis through Deuteronomy. But these numbers that are recorded here and how they also match up with the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is an extra biblical, it's not an inspired record, But that ancient book also talks about people having very, very long lives that almost directly parallel what we see here. So there's other extra biblical records that talk about similar ages. So that's something that's worth noting and very interesting, and to see how lives were pretty stable and pretty long. I mean, Noah was building the ark longer than probably any of us in this room will live. And he just had that one construction project for over 100 years. And then eventually the ark was done. And then he lived hundreds of years more after the flood was over as well. So that's quite fascinating. And then another thing that's interesting to notice is the repeated references to death. Oh, you want to say something first?
Well, even just I was just saying, we were at a funeral yesterday. And I was telling a friend how this week I had my birthday and I'm 46 now, but getting close to, close to 50, but I feel like I still feel like I'm in college. She goes, I know, I still feel like that way too. You still feel like a kid, and I'm not a grown up yet, but here I am with an adult son, and there's a feeling of youth, and we, you know, our childhood is quite vivid, and then as we age, like Julie's mom, you know, we start forgetting things, the more I think about that kind of stuff, and this week's not the first time, the fact that I feel young, I feel like I could keep going for a long time in my mind, but my body's breaking down already. And looking in the mirror, you realize I'm not a kid, those kinds of things. But in my mind, I feel like, and I just think it would not be hard it's not hard for me to take that leap into thinking I could live 1,000 years, right? Like, it's that kind of a thing. Like, there's so much more to learn, so much more to do. If you had the body that would go with the mind that was full of energy. And even then, also, I can't remember where it was at, but thinking about the end times, and I was starting to think it's a revelation, but it's probably an Old Testament prophecy of how you're young. I thought it was in Revelation, but I couldn't find it off the top of my head. But where you're young, you will die young in the end times if you're dying less than 1,000 years, kind of, or 500. I don't remember what
it is to 100 years. It's a revelation.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and check the reference. Isaiah talks about that too. Revelation.
Isaiah. I went to both books, but I couldn't think off the top of my head.
Eternity is set in the hearts of men.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but yeah, it was talking about that they'll be dancing the streets once again, mm-hmm. and the marriages will be happening once again, and that the older generation, they're going to be living so much longer. Mm-hmm. And if you're dying at 100 years, you're probably a man of sin, kind of a thing. Like, you're filled up with the wrath of God in that way. So,
yeah, good points. Yeah, and our souls are designed to be immortal. We are immortal souls, and we will spend eternity conscious. So, yes, we have kind of this built-in sense of it's wrong, it's unnatural to think about this life just ending at 60, 70, 80, whatever, right. 100 years. Like, that doesn't seem right. Like, we feel like, man, I'm just getting started. Well, you are, in a sense. And thankfully, we have the hope of a resurrected body, so we will live again, even if we do die, unless that rapture comes first, which we would all be very thankful for, and look forward to the return of Christ and believe it could happen at any moment. It could happen in 2023. We got a few hours, guys, still, so don't give up yet. But whenever it happens, you know, for those of us that if the Lord takes us home first before his return, then our souls will live on and our bodies will be laid to rest, but only temporary until they're reunited with our bodies. It'll be remade and glorified. And yeah, you're right that, and we've ministered to a lot of seniors and done a lot of funerals over the years, and like, so many people toward those latter years of life say, I just don't feel old yet, like on the inside, how could this happen so fast? And it really does feel like the blink of an eye and just a vapor. So yeah, it puts things in perspective. And
you kind of wish you could live the 930 years, you know,
and if your body would cooperate. Yes, I think so.
Right.
But it gets to the point, you're like, man, I'm tapping out. I'm just, I can't go anymore. Take me home, Lord. So, yeah, one thing we definitely notice here is the long lives. That makes this genealogy unique in Scripture. Another is the repeated references to death. And just as you're reading, you almost have to read it out loud and listen to it being read to hear this. But if I just read, again, the end of each of these short little paragraphs, verse 5, all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Verse 8, all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Verse 11, all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. Verse 14, and he died. Verse 17, and he died. Verse 20, and he died. Like, this is meant to get across a point. Every single one of these people, just as God had warned Adam and Eve in the garden, that if you eat of this tree, you will surely die. Here we are in chapter 5. We've already seen the murder of a child by his brother, or a young man by his brother, and now we're seeing death, 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 death. It's taking its course throughout the entire human race, and nobody's exempt from that. Go ahead.
That's an interesting thing, that the first death was a murder.
Yeah.
That just, like, hit me right now. Like, wow. I never thought of that.
Yeah, that is very sobering and sad. So both those that prematurely and unnaturally take a life, and then also those that just slowly decay and die, we're seeing death spread throughout the entire human race. And only the heads of households are being mentioned here, but certainly wives died, children, which would be the next generations, are dying as well. You know, it talked in chapter 4 about Cain's offspring, but the focus wasn't on the death. It was just on, basically, from Cain all the way to Lamech, it was talking about the family and who each next generation was and the development of technologies that were taking place and whatnot. But here, in particular, in chapter 5, which is, this is part of the messianic line. These are the early generations of the seed of the woman that's going to eventually lead toward the coming of Messiah. And there's death, 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 death through each new generation. And yet, there is one exception to that, isn't there? Someone named Enoch, mentioned in verse 21, when Enoch had lived 65 years, he fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years, so that would give us 365 years total, and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So there's a break in the pattern of both what happened before and also what's going to be mentioned again afterward with his son Methuselah that will live till 969 and die, and Lamech, who will die, is that Enoch does not die. Enoch is taken, and we see this repeated in the New Testament as well, that Enoch in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5, he was a man of faith, and he was taken by God. He did not experience death. So we could call this an early rapture, that we don't know exactly the form in which Enoch was taken. You know, if he just kind of vanished, if he, like Elijah, he would be the only other case in the Bible. In the New Testament, we have Elijah that does not experience death, but he's actually climbing onto this chariot pulled by horses of fire, and he's taken up into the heavens, and he doesn't have to experience death. So those are the only two people who ever did not die, but immediately were translated into the presence of God. And, you know, as far as our doctrine of the second coming and why do we believe that there is a rapture, there's different views that scholars have. But I look and I find hope in a story like Enoch, that he does protect his righteous people. And there are cases, there are biblical cases where people did not have to experience death or God's judgment, but they were taken away before he poured out judgment on the earth. And Enoch would be an example of that, that he was a righteous man. Many, many godly men and women, they will die. It's not that we you know, can't expect that to happen, but there are people that God has taken away and preserved them or protected them from having to experience death. And Enoch is an encouragement to us, and certainly all of us want to aspire. Wouldn't it be great if the one thing sort of on your tombstone was, this man, this woman walked with God. They knew God. And we want that to be true of us. And that's what Enoch is remembered for in the midst of a very dark world that within just another generation or so, it's going to be so wicked that God is about to wipe it out. But Enoch was a righteous man that walked with God. So those are a few observations. Anything else that any of you wanted to share from chapter 5? Okay, well, today and the next 2 weeks, we're going to focus on Noah's flood. And we've all experienced small-scale disasters like regional floods, brush fires, minor earthquakes. Those things occur literally every day somewhere on the earth. You know, I think about it was just about a year ago now that we had all that rain and all that snow. And, you know, it, in one sense, we could call that small scale. But I tell you, for those that were up there in the mountains and were trapped, it did not feel like a small scale disaster in that moment. But can anybody think of a larger scale disaster that either you've experienced or maybe that you've seen the effects of that afterward and what that taught you?
Well, Southern California, we have fires. So there were several, I mean, there's been several times that there's been big fires, but there was one time when there was one that started over like in the Del Rosa area and then came across, it came all the way to Highland and they stopped it in Highland, but there was like a ton of devastation, people losing their homes. And
there's a lot of evacuation.
It went up into the mountain too.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long ago was that? Like 10, 15 years?
2003.
Wow, 20 yeah. years ago
the
now.
Fire?
October 19th to 28th, to the end of October.
Yeah.
Wow.
It seemed like that. It was more recent.
Speaking of time
like
passing.
20 years ago.
Wow, October 2003 then was the big Del Rosa fire. Okay.
That was just before we moved. Uh-huh.
We moved to Yucca Valley in 2006. And there was a big fire, like our second week of moving out there.
Oh. Your first Sunday, and we went to church, or after church, we went to lunch, and we came out, and there's like this, I think it's an old, like, kind of electrical billboard kind of a thing, but it's this big white billboard on a hill. And it's not really a billboard, but we looked out, like, oh, there's a little bit of smoke, and the people who were from there, they're like, oh, that's in this area. Well, we had to drive back to Santa Clarita. And so that fire just took off. That was in Pioneer Town and Pipes Canyon and all that, Morongo. And so the fire a couple years ago around here, like, it was hitting that burn scar from in 2006. Yeah. But we were back in Santa Clarita watching our people, our brand new congregation, and being in trouble and devastation. And we're just listening on the radio.
Kind of helpless at the moment.
It was weird.
Yeah, but we had people evacuate and some that lost some of their property and everything from that.
Yeah.
Anybody else gone through a natural disaster or witnessed the aftermath?
Sure, multiple times growing up in Light of Crete. So it's unpredictable and it shows what can happen. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I mean, thanks to God's grace, you know, fire come right up to the cluster of my parents' homes 4 times in my lifetime and was stopped every time.
Wow. Praise God.
But of course, flooding and everything else.
Yes. You know, it's interesting when you read through the prophets, you know, you get into the later prophets in the Bible, so Isaiah, Jeremiah, Joel. Joel talks about a locust plague. And the prophets will use different disasters that are going on in their day as a reminder of, like, God is going to judge. And these things give us a little snapshot of what his larger scale judgment will be. So, you know, when disasters take place, there's a lot of emotions that are running through our head. You know, we can be scared for our own lives and for loved ones. We're praying for protection. We're praying for first responders and the danger that they're going through and the heroic efforts that they have. We're certainly relieved, you know, if things are put out quickly. When you see these forces, especially like fire and water or the earth shaking, like the one thing that you hope will be stable is the ground underneath you. And when that all of a sudden is moving and you just feel like I have nothing I can hold on to that's stable right now, when these kinds of things happen, it's natural for us to be afraid and to panic. And yet, at the same time, like, okay, God's in control. He's going to get us through this. We can trust in him. But one of many thoughts that we should have is thanksgiving to God that we're not under his ultimate judgment if we've trusted in Christ. and also warning that life is short and there's no guarantee of tomorrow. And for those that don't know the Lord, like, these are little warning signs of the fact that greater judgment is coming. Romans 8 talks about how the world, the earth, is groaning in birth pains for the arrival of Jesus Christ. And when we see disasters take place, those are kind of early labor pains showing that a greater cosmic judgment is going to happen. And Genesis 6 through 9 is looking backwards. It's looking in the rearview mirror of a major, major earth-sized judgment event that took place. And sometimes even to the present day, in laws and insurance policies, they'll use language like acts of God to describe things. Even when people don't even believe in God, they use this kind of language of like a biblical proportion event that only, you know, you read about in the Bible, or that you think about God having some kind of power over. So as we study this through, you know, we are sobered by the fact that disaster takes place, sometimes on a small scale, sometimes on a large scale. A number of years ago, we went up to the Pacific Northwest, got to visit some friends, but we also stopped by Mount St. Helens, and it's both beautiful and terrifying at the same time to like see how regrowth can take place, but also just the sheer size of the devastation of one volcanic eruption and what it can do, you know. And then of course, you know, there was a hurricane and the fires that took place in Lahaina, the winds and then the fires this last summer, and volcanic activity that happens in Hawaii. So no matter where you go, like, there's something, right? Like, Natalie's parents just moved to Oklahoma. Now they're close to Tornado Alley. They didn't have to worry about tornadoes out here quite as much, but they knew about earthquakes while they're out here. And now there's a different kind of disaster depending on where you go to. And sometimes they can hit back to back to back. We had some people that were visiting our church up in Yucca Valley for a while, and they had gone through Hurricane Katrina down in New Orleans, and they were displaced, and then went to Texas for a while and eventually worked their way out here. And then there were other things out here that they were struggling with. But we kind of feel like we're always on the run and trying to brace ourselves and to mitigate risk and danger and disaster that takes place. And here we see a massive global disaster, which we're very thankful has not repeated since this time. And there's a promise that it will not repeat in the same way. But it does remind us of a future judgment that will take place as well. So let's read verses 13 through 14 of Genesis chapter 6 and see what God has to say to Noah and what his instructions are. Can somebody read those two verses?
13 and 14?
Yeah.
So God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people. For the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood, make rooms in it, and coat it with pitch inside and out.
Okay, thank you. So why did God say that he was going to destroy the earth with water? And actually, he didn't say in these verses he's going to destroy it with water, but he did say build a big boat. So we're going somewhere with this thing. But but why did he say he's doing that?
The violence.
The violence. That's the specific explanation that he gives here, right, in verse 13.
Verse 5 also, which we skipped, but the mm-hmm. Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
Right, and verse 6, again, describing God's response to this. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. Can you imagine? I mean, imagine having a child and that child creating so much damage that you almost regret even having that child. That's a horrible thought, and I would hope that would never happen to any of us. And, you know, we're not responsible for ultimately the decisions that our children have made. We are responsible to disciple them and to point them in the right direction and point them to God and pray for them and so forth. But imagine, like, putting your heart and your life into something only to regret that that thing ever existed because of the great harm and damage that's been done through that. And it's mysterious to us. Of course, this did not surprise God. God knew what would take place. But God is a person. God is spirit, but he's also a person. And a person does have emotions. And our emotions that we experience are part of being made in the image of God. So when we experience things like joy, we're echoing the perfect joy that God has. When we experience sorrow, we're experiencing in some small way the kind of sorrow and regret that God can experience when he sees sin and evil and brokenness as well, and suffering. So here it talks about how the Lord was sorry. He in a sense, regretted that he had made man on the earth, and he chose to blot out mankind and everything that would be on the earth. And so he tells Noah and his family to build an ark. What was different about Noah than the violence that was around? If you look at verse 9, it explains that. Can somebody read verse 9?
This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God.
All right, amen. So we saw earlier that Enoch walked with God, and here it says that Noah walked with God, whereas God took Enoch miraculously so that he didn't experience death. For Noah, he did something different. God doesn't always act in the same way. And for Noah, he chooses to keep him on the earth, but to put protection around him where he's going to go through this judgment event of the flood. Of course, this theme of violence, it does go back to Genesis chapter 3 and the initial sin and the curse and the judgment of how it would be in pain that there would be childbearing, it would be through suffering that there would be tending the field, that there would be animosity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman's, and how the woman would want authority over the man. So we already saw conflict in chapter 3. In chapter 4, of course, we saw, as Mike pointed out, the very first death was really death by murder. We saw violence there in a very graphic way. In chapter 5, we saw death after death after death. But also at the end of chapter 4, we saw something interesting last week that Lamech said to his two wives. Polygamy was introduced into the human race, and there was an abuse of God's original design for one man, one woman. But anybody remember what Lamech had said about those that mistreated him?
Wasn't it that they would be worse off than what would happen to people who attacked Cain?
Yeah, exactly.
Seven times or something.
Right. So he's warning, instead of the idea of like eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, he's saying, if you stick your finger in my eye, I'm going to take your head off, kind of a thing. Like I'm going to escalate the violence rather than equally pay back for what's been done against me, or to de-escalate it. So whatever Cain was going to get, just wait till you experience Lamech's wrath. And so we call that vigilante justice. It's not in a court system. It's not the court of law. It's not with a judge who's impartial or with a jury made up of the people. But vigilante justice is like, oh, you did something to me? Wait till you get my payback. So you're going to regret what you ever did, and nobody will ever want to mess with me again. And Lamech had that mindset. And that kind of justice system, if you want to call it justice at all, was just taking over the world, where everybody was like, hey, whatever you do to me, I'm going to do it 10 times worse toward you. So people are building weapons. People are plotting of how they can get revenge on other people. And more anger, more revenge, more violence is taking over the world until it's to the point where just everything's bloody and horrible, and God has to purge it to get it back into a place where it's under control and he can reestablish humanity and also put in a law system. Our governments are not perfect. They are far from perfect. But government, Romans 13 says, that those are ministers for our good. And part of their role is that they preserve order in society and that they put laws in place. And those laws are not always perfectly acted out. And we know that politicians often do things that are against what their promises are that they're going to do. They can often lie or have their own agendas. But we should be thankful that government exists. And government is meant to give order to society. And we should be very thankful for the rule of law and for some kind of a court system that tries to defend the innocent and to punish the guilty. And that's part of what's going to come out of the story of Genesis chapter 6 through 9 as well. So we see rampant violence that causes God to say to Noah, I want you to build an ark. Now, an ark simply means a chest or a container or even a casket, if you want to think about it that way. This is basically like a floating casket out at sea on a very, very large scale. Interestingly, the word appears again. Again, Moses writes these five books of Genesis through Deuteronomy, and the same word is used in Exodus chapter 2, verse 3. Anybody happen to know offhand what story speaks of a casket or a box or a container in Exodus chapter 2?
The Ark of the Covenant?
That's a good guess. That would have been my first guess. But it's even before that, actually.
Moses is the basket.
Yeah. His mom. Yeah. Moses. So the little basket that Moses gets put into is the same word. He gets put into an ark. He gets put in a little ark and floated into the Nile where his life is preserved. So interestingly, same word. Here, Noah's told, build an ark, build a container, which is going to be a container fit for humanity and also for animals to be able to survive and to ride out this storm that is coming. We don't know a lot of the details in construction. We are told the dimensions. The ark was 450 feet long, so that would be about 1.5 football fields long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. I don't know how tall our building here is. I'm guessing maybe 30, 35 feet. I don't know when you got a couple stories and a tall roof on it, but you know, taller from down below all the way up to the very peak of our rooftop here and our building. So 45 feet high, basically three stories high is what scripture tells us. And it was perfectly suited to preserve an abundance of life on the open sea. We're not quite sure what kind of wood was used here. Some translations say gopher wood. I think Mike just said cypress, didn't you?
Yeah, mine says cypress. Yeah. But most of them are gopher.
Yeah. We don't know what gopher wood is. We know the gophers like wood, but we don't know what gopher wood is. and scholars do wonder if maybe this is referring to cedar or cypress, which were well known as good woods in the ancient world, good for construction. Anybody been to the Ark Encounter? Over in Kentucky.
I want to go. I haven't, though.
Yeah.
I like museums.
Yeah, it's well worth it. I had the joy of going back in April. I was on a trip in Kentucky for something else, and I took Dylan with me, and we were able to go to the Ark Encounter. And it's a long way away from us out here in California, so you'd really have to plan ahead for a family vacation or a long road trip or something like that. But it's well worth it. It's well worth a day or two to be able to really work your way through. And they did build a full-size ark, and they tried to utilize as much of the technology of what was back then. So they had expert woodworkers. A lot of the Amish were people that know how to use, like how to manually build things, and all the mortise and tenons and all the fittings and everything really tight. So it's a masterpiece to even see the woodworking design of it and the multiple chambers that are there to make it watertight and so forth. And I mean, you see it from miles away, and you park in this large parking lot and you ride a shuttle to get to where the ark is. And then you get off the shuttle and there's a welcome center and a guest area and a theater. And they've got a beautiful lake there in front of the ark, so it's kind of reflective off of the lake. And you walk through these gardens, and they just designed it so professionally and beautifully. There's some little zoo cages and animals that are around in different areas. But you walk up multiple platforms to get up to the door to go into the ark. And as you're getting up there, it's kind of like you're going on a Disney ride. I mean, you're in this long line, and you're hearing music around you, and it's just a beautiful setting. But then you get up to the entrance of the ark, and it starts to get dark. And then you hear on the speakers the rumbling of thunder. And then you go into the ark, and the speakers change to where a downpour starts, and you're hearing the thunder, and you're seeing the flashes of lightning. And then you go in, and it gets really dark, and you hear the creaking of the boat, and you hear all these little chirping of animals and things that are in these cages. And it really is a full immersive experience, like you're on board the ark, and it's a little scary. Like you're kind of like, whoa, man, I'm glad I'm on this thing right now, because it sounds like it's a downpour outside. And you go through it, and they've just thought through so many details of what life might have been like. To help people realize this is plausible. I mean, the Bible says it, and in a sense, that's all we need. When the Bible says something happens, we can trust God, and he's given us this reliable record of his inerrant word, but it's helpful, and it's an amazing, it's a full-size track to say God is real, his word is trustworthy, his judgment is coming, but his mercy is also rich. And God has provided an escape from his judgment. And that's ultimately why the people poured millions and millions of dollars into this ark encounter, so people could go and see the judgment and the mercy of God in a life-size fashion. So it's pretty amazing, and I highly recommend that you see it someday. But the size of it is incredible, and you get to the very middle of the ark, and you can look down both directions, and they've got these images of like a 747 on a little sign there, and it says like from here to the south end of the boat, you could fit a 747 on this side. And then you look the other direction and it talks about like how you could fit a major cargo vessel between here and the other side. And when you're in the middle of it, I mean, you're just swallowed up in this massive ship that is simply following the same dimensions that are described right here in Scripture. So it's pretty cool. Let's continue on to read verses 15 through 22. Can somebody read that for us?
This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top and put the door of the ark on the side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. Now behold, I myself am bringing up the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which there is breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds according to their kind, and of the animals according to their kind. Of every crawling thing of the ground according to its kind, two of every kind will come up to you and keep them alive, will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of every food that is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and them. So Noah did these things according to everything that God had commanded him, so he did.
Okay, thank you, Jessica. So again, here we have a description of the size and the dimensions of the ark. We're told about a roof or a window. We're told about the door that's to be built on the side. Three different decks. Here we're told in verse 17 that the flood of waters will come upon the earth, so that's going to be the means of God's destruction and judgment. And verse 17 says, everything that is on the earth shall die. Now, of course, aquatic creatures, you know, they get to stay out in the water and out in the ocean. There probably was, well, I know there was a lot of destruction of aquatic animals as well, because the fossil record has tons and tons and tons, like millions and millions of sea creatures that were destroyed during the flood. And part of that is because you have waters not only coming down from the sky, but you have waters bursting up from underneath the earth. So massive cracks of subterranean oceans that are coming up and water is being released. And you're having tumbling and washing of sand over the ocean floors. So you're having a lot, and this is very interesting, but a secular scientist would say we can see the progression of life from the simplest kind of life forms into more complex organisms as you go further up the different layers of sediment. And first of all, there's exceptions to that that evolutionists can't explain, whether it's more complex or the same creatures that are here as that are here. But another thing to keep in mind is that a lot of those lowest layers that we have were actually layers of ocean floor, where you had water and you had sediment that was covering up things that were already down there. So we would expect to find a lot of sea creatures and simpler organisms down further at the base of all the sediment layers. So when you go to the Grand Canyon, for example, the lowest levels of the Grand Canyon mostly are aquatic creatures. That would have been ocean prior to the flood, and those things were covered up. And when I traveled there a couple years ago, and we had a couple of creation scientists and geologists, they were showing us, in particular, we stopped at this one place that had these, they're called nautiloid fossils, and there were other places that you could just walk around and take a hike, but you could pick up rocks and find little seashells that were fossilized and things like that. So a lot of this would have been underwater even at the time of the flood, but then it got covered up, and life immediately, when it's covered with mud or dune, and there's a lot of compression in a short amount of time with that much weight and pressure, it will fossilize very quickly, and then the water will, you know, be pushed out of it and squeezed out of it, and it'll turn into rock. So anyway, you have a lot of sea life that is going to die, but a lot of sea life is going to live and survive through the flood. But all the land animals, if they're going to survive, they're going to have to be in a safe haven, and that's why God designs the ark. Right now, today, in the present day, there are over a million species of animals in the world. But creation scientists estimate that there were less than 20,000 kinds of animals necessary to preserve the entire genetic blueprint of all species to replenish the earth. So even though we have a lot of different species and diversification today, just keep in mind that many of those species could be traced back in a family tree to ancestors in the past that carry the genetic code. A classic example would be dogs. You could have one kind of proto dog or one wolf-like dog creature that has in it all the genetic coding from everything from a Chihuahua to a Great Dane and a wolf and a coyote and a jackal and all these different kinds of animals that would seem quite distinct. I mean, they look somewhat similar, but they're still pretty different. But they really only needed one ancestor that had all the genetics for all the different ways that they are bred and all the different kinds of adaptations that have happened over the last several thousand years. So God had made sure that all the different kinds each found at least one mom and dad that were there in the ark to protect them to get through this. And maybe you've seen the comics. I've seen the comics of like all the animals climbing up on the ark, and then the unicorns are kind of running behind and the doors shut before the unicorns get in. And oh no, that's why they've been lost and we don't have them anymore, is because they didn't make it on the ark. Well, God does say that two of every kind made it on the ark. So there were no species, unless they were already extinct before the flood. I don't know if maybe that happened in some cases, but there were no species that were alive at the time of Noah that didn't make it on the ark. He ensured that everything had the means of an escape. Now, everything would have been endangered. You know, there literally was only one male and one female of almost every land animal, with the exception of the clean animals. So if Ham and Shem and Japheth really got hungry for bacon and they went and killed that pig and ate bacon for dinner, that's it. That's the end of the pigs. So yeah, they had to make sure they controlled themselves and that the animals didn't get a hold of each other. But you did have the preservation of every single different type of animal over the course of a year on the ark. Well, we'll stop there for today. Want to make sure we have time to get over to the church service. We'll talk at the beginning next week about some proofs for a global flood and not just a local or a regional flood. And then we'll continue our study in the rest of chapters 7, 8, and 9 next week as well. So
if you guys come over tonight, we do have, I think you have it out, that Noah's Ark book that we have.
It's like a children's storybook.
It's beautiful artwork. And they show in art form of like what the ark would have looked like. It's not a ship because there's no motor and all that. But and then the animals in cages and dinosaurs being on the ark and all of that. So it's just such a neat book. So if you want to flip through it tonight, if you come over.
Yeah, you'll have to pull that out so it's available if you want to look at it.
Absolutely.
Do you know where it's at?
I think I do.
There's a lot of boxes in the garage.
No,
so
you got it out. Okay. Out for your studies. For the creation study.
Unless we'll see.
At church here for the creation study. We'll try and have it out.
But this picture that Glorice did, that's a pretty realistic depiction too. A little box and a big ocean. Okay. Have a great week, guys. Happy New Year to you. And we'd love to have you over tonight if you don't have other plans.